come back to the public library here. We'll do a 1.5 hour outreach at the library so that people can actually speak to the artists and learn about the world. A couple years ago, I took some young friends of mine, who are from Iraq, and we went to hear an Arabic musician, and they spoke Arabic with this woman, and they don't speak a lot of Arabic with musicians, and she was very gracious and kind, and it's just a really good way to get kids involved. And then, of course, the following day, they're down by the riverside for the Capstone concerts. We're doing that. We've supported 13 education and community outreach services, and we've got plans to support 9 more in 2015. We're doing the Rochester Fest concert band, and of course, the 4th of July celebration. That's, again, 54 uniques, unrelated to Thursdays on 1st and 3rd. We've already done by June, so we've got a half year more to worry about things, right? And then down by the, Thursdays on 1st, we'll have 48 distinct musical performances that Steve programs and helps to produce. And of course, we plan to negotiate a new contract with the RDA for the next 3 years. We're on our second year now with the current contract.
It's actually the third.
Third year, and we're hoping to get another 3 years. Again, this year we've served more students, 2,400 students from southeastern Minnesota through our education and outreach program. This year it was the ukulele boys that went out to the various. So, you know, it's cold in March, and it was nice to see ukuleles going out to the schools and in their nice Hawaiian festival shirts. And then, of course, as Steve will discuss, we've done this within budget. For the past 25 out of 26 years, we've been in the black, which is, again, an impressive thing for an arts organization to be able to shout out. It's a very, very busy four-person staff we have, and we're pleased as board members to serve. As board members, I think I speak for all of us, so I look over them. We attend concerts, we distribute surveys, we use social media, we seek out donations, and we advocate for the department. And we do this because we believe in the importance of art, and certainly the importance of music in Rochester as part of our quality of life, and how we can be better people because of this. Of course, in 2015, in the future, there's always challenges, because the future always brings challenges. And Steve's going to discuss some of that more specifically, about where we're going to be able to hold concerts in the next few years, with the center's expansion, and how we're making adjustments to that. But it also suggests this is a time now that we can consider performance space that will meet the current market demands of smaller halls and flexible seating and standing options. A space like that would conserve our diverse community better and be a better showcase for the kinds of music and performances that people enjoy. That's part of our strategic planning. Again, brought in part because of the Civic Center, the center's changes, the DMC, and of course, you know, the senior center moving out of the Armory and the city's purchase of the Chateau all come into this. But this, we've been talking about these kinds of space issues well before even DMC came to the table. This is just something that's always been of concern. You've all seen letters from the board talking about the possibilities of this department managing a performance space, whether it's the Chateau or the Armory or even something altogether new. Such a center would allow the department to program beyond what it already does and lets the city have a home for all sorts of interesting things, Broadway musicals, dance performances, a home for the symphony, and if we want to dream big, let's include some opera. We could do that. And it's not so out of reach. We're at a pivotal moment in the city, a time when many things seem possible, and in fact are possible if we plan appropriately. When I first met with Steve in the fall of 2011 to find out about the board, he spent some time telling me a little bit of history about the music department, that it goes back to 1936, that it does well with what it has. And he also said that in the early days, the Mayo brothers funded the Civic Music Program because they hoped to have a community, and I quote, which patients and their relatives would enjoy visiting, and a community in which Mayo personnel and families would enjoy living. The music department does that now, did it then, and we continue with council support to continue to do that. So I hope to see you all down by the riverside, and I'm going to send my propaganda across to let you know that these are the concerts that are coming, so please share them. I hope to see you at Thursdays on 1st and 3rd for our world music concerts and all the other concerts that the department has programmed. And again, you've seen behind me who's coming in the fall for the Riverside Live concerts. So I hope you enjoy the music as much as we enjoy bringing it to you. Thank you.
I get to talk about numbers now. Thank you, Carol. Again, I want to reiterate that my staff of four, that includes Senate's number, Chris Alcott, who's here, he's my assistant general manager, and two other folks, The three of us supported 104 distinct services last fiscal year, serving over 252,000 citizens and visitors. As Carol said, we have ended 25 of the last 26 fiscal years with an operating surplus. When I began my tenure with the city back in 1989, I inherited a deficit of $165,000. It's because of the good work of this department and because of the leadership of previous councils that we were able to retire that deficit and produce this surplus. This surplus enables our work, and it makes it possible for us to plan seasons and book in advance, to negotiate concerts that occur in future fiscal years, and to stand by those agreements. If council were to take this fund balance away, it would be game over for the music department as we know it. It wouldn't be possible for us to continue to do the kind of Down by the Riverside concert series the public has come to expect. We wouldn't be able to program as many concerts as we do inside the Mayo Civic Center. It wouldn't be possible for us to do Thursdays on 1st and 3rd, and other programs, services, and subsidies provided by the music department would need to be curtailed. Last fiscal year, we had an operating surplus of $12,000, but our net surplus was almost $250,000. I do expect the department to end fiscal 2015 in the black. The estimated economic impact of the music department was over $6 million last year. The impact of our audiences alone was $4.8 million, and we're well on target to exceed those figures this fiscal year. Let me put something else on at a finer point. The music department provided $1.68 worth of programming for every dollar council invested in the music department. What that means is for every dollar of general fund dollar invested, the music department generated 63 cents from non-city sources, ticket sales, grants, concert sponsorships, contributions, fees, etc. And when you include that rolling fund balance, that investment leveraged $1.05. I'd say that's a pretty good bargain in any economy. I've received some questions in the past about the RDA work that we do. The value of the contract for services with the RDA for the services we provide, that is to be the talent buyer, the curator, the artistic director of Thursdays on 1st and 3rd, is currently $85,000. That's a $10,000 return on investment of the city, $75,000 that we invest in the RDA. In rough numbers, about $45,000 of that amount goes to pay for the artists, and about $40,000 of that amount goes to pay for music production costs. Depending upon the fiscal year, we can sometimes net out 5 to 10% of that amount to help us offset our overhead. It may be possible in future fiscal years and future contracts to negotiate a higher margin. I would hope that we would be able to achieve a 10 to 15% margin going forward, but it's clear that the RDA has not yet signaled whether or not they want the music department to continue in that role, but we hope that they will. The music department generated last fiscal year $105,000 in revenue for the Mayo Civic Center. Of that amount is $67,000 in direct expenses that we paid to the Civic Center associated with producing our various concerts. That included building rent, equipment rent, labor expenses for stagehands, box office staff, ushers, etc., and for catering. These costs comprised about 7% of the music department's budget last fiscal year. We also generated $5,000 through the $1 ticket surcharge that the Civic Center collects, and about $33,000 in catering that was sold, concessions sold during civic music events. Turning our attention to challenges and opportunities, staff capacity is indeed a challenge. It would be difficult to implement any new or expand current programs without additional staff resources. But again, I want to recapitulate how very effective and productive this staff is. a staff of four, supporting 104 events, serving 252,000 citizens and visitors. When it comes time to build or acquire a new patio cover for the Mayo Civic Center, it's critical that that system be designed to accommodate Down by the Riverside concert needs. It has to cover the stage footprint, be able to fly sound equipment, lighting instruments, etc., provide side protection from sun and rain, that type of thing. Our partners at the Civic Center are already working with us, but we want council to be aware that the music department has already spent $56,000 to rent a temporary structure over the last three fiscal years to support Down by the Riverside. 4 years ago, we estimated the cost of acquiring such a system, which the music department spent, would be $100,000. If council determines that the chateau and or the armory are to be municipally staffed and government programmed agencies, and if you turn to the music department to manage those spaces, we would need to come forward with requests for several full-time positions and a number of part-time positions that would need to be included in the budget. But please know we're not asking for any adjustments to our staffing table at this time. That concludes our presentation, and President Verdiotti and I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, well, thank you. Let me start off here. First off, you should be applauded for the program you put forth, the variety, the people you reach. It's an outstanding program that we should be proud of. Steve, you did touch a little bit on my one question that I want to talk about a little bit, and that is some of the budget, and specifically the carryover. As you perhaps touched on, in fiscal year 2014, there was a $254,000 carryover, and then from 14 to 15, a $222,000 carryover. And this probably isn't a discussion for today and doesn't involve just the music department. Mr. Quenvold and I had a very brief discussion about this earlier today. My concern is that we are equitable in how we treat all of our departments. In many cases, our departments, if they enjoy a surplus, you know, through efficient operations or whatever, that flows over into the general fund. The music department is allowed to carry over and use those funds, in other words, keep them. And I'm not necessarily opposed to that. I'm just saying this is a discussion for another day, that we are equitable in how we treat all of our departments. I'm not opposed, for example, to departments being allowed to keep a surplus. But I might suggest that maybe there should be some caveats there. So, for example, maybe half, just making that number up, half could be used for operational purposes of whatever programming is needed, and the other half is designated for future capital improvement. So, for example, you save some money toward an outdoor stage cover or something of that nature. So, again, it's not necessarily a question I'm looking for you to answer. It's not germane solely to the music department, but I think I bring that up more for the council than anything. I think we need to be equitable as we treat our departments in how they manage surpluses from 1 year to the next. So, again, just my comment to get us started.
I would like to say, though, President Staver, that we do generate 40 to 50% of the revenue that comes into the department from outside sources. So some of that is profit that we have generated that we then reinvest in additional programming for our citizens.
Yeah, and again, I'm not opposed to that. It's great that operations are such that you've been able to manage things and you generate a surplus. I'm just suggesting that, you know, how we manage that going forward within the music department or across other departments, that we are very similar in how we treat the departments. That's all. So, Mr. Wojcik.
And I understand what you're saying. I guess I've been around, you know, I remember hearing about the days of the deficits and how that got closed off and, you know, the run of success that they've had. And I know it's, you know, I guess I view this a little bit more like a fund, because a lot of our departments deal, their principal expenses are staffing costs that are more on an annual basis. And the thing you got to remember here is we've got contracts that, you know, go out 2-3 years, and they need to, essentially what they have is they have budget reserves through their management of the funds to help ensure that those contracts can be funded at the front end. And I agree, we need to treat the departments equitable. We just need to make sure that we have, you know, currently the process of making sure we can back those contracts is through the surplus, and we just need to be able to continue to make sure we can do that. And, you know, the other thing, too, I always like to point out with this department is it's not one of our higher dollar areas, and we get a lot of, we do get a lot of bang for the buck for them, and I do really appreciate that. I appreciate the comments on the armory and the chateau. You're the first people that have ever expressed an interest in that, so I appreciate that. I don't know where the discussions are for the future of the Chateau Theater, but I really do hope, and I'm going to advocate that Civic Music have a seat at the table when we're doing that discussions, because they've been such fabulous facility managers for things that aren't necessarily even a facility, like, you know, the backside of the Mayo Civic Center. I've always appreciated the work they've done on Thursdays on First and Third. I think is just wonderful. Every time I go down there to hear a band that I'm not interested in, I'm interested in it. So, you know, really, always been impressed. I've said it for 7 years. I've been impressed with the work that the department does for the very little money that we've put in there. And I thank you, and I thank your board as well. You have some really fantastic people on there. So I do appreciate that. This will be the 7th consecutive year, and this is not on this department, but I'm saying that as much as I love, I still want to see event parking for our free concerts, particularly since the biggest objector to that would probably be the library, and they're not even open on Sundays in the summer. But I love providing this for our citizens. I wouldn't mind the folks from Byron, you know, paying $5-$10 for parking to come enjoy it as well to help offset our costs. The passing the bucket is nice. Yeah.
People who do park actually on the surface lots.
Yeah.
Are to pay the pay boxes on Sunday nights, and they are now ticketed if they don't.
The surface lots.
The surface lots, not the ramps, but the surface lots. Yes.
Well, we'll get you a little extra funding from the ramps, and This is my 7th year of requesting it, so one of these years we'll hopefully get it done. I just think that we provide some great services, and it's not too much to ask that we treat ourselves like any other big city, and, you know, recoup a little bit of that income to help support the programs. And, you know, last, and I don't know where this will stand, but we've been talking about for a long time. We've talked about a band shell somewhere, possibly, you know, whether it's the back of Mayo Civic Center. There was a proposal in the for the Cascade Lake area at one point as well. And, you know, whenever those discussions should come to be, I hope you'll be a part of that as well. But, you know, I appreciate the presentation, appreciate the numbers, and thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Mr. Ruska.
Thank you, guys. Nice job with everything. I got two questions. One point to kind of tag on with Randy saying, I think when I hear that we're in the black and we're running with a surplus, I think it's important to note that we do have $621,000 coming out of the tax levy with the $222,000 that's carried over, so $844,000 of taxpayer dollars that's creating that revenue to get us in the black. So it's not like the operations are paying for themselves, but with the budgeted money from the tax levy, we're in the surplus. Is that correct to say?
We do receive the $600,000 from the tax levy, absolutely.
And with the 200-some thousand carryover, then that makes it over 800,000. So just to kind of note that on what Randy was saying. And then the thing that I was interested in was you mentioned economic impact dollars, and how do you come about that? Because that's always interesting to see how people get. Is that direct spending, or is it using the multiplier, or are you using it per head, or how do you figure that?
That's usually the calculator provided by the Rochester Area Greater Cultural Trust and the Americans for the Arts Group. We plug in those figures into the calculator, and it comes up with those figures for us.
Mr. Campion.
Okay. Thanks again. The presentation is good. I think people say the word of your good goes before you, and that's certainly the way this one has gotten. I've gotten several emails just talking about how good the civic music does for Rochester. I would say, I'd caution on the idea that we have to treat all of the groups equitably. I think what we have to do is be able to justify why we treat a group differently. And to me, it's pretty obvious that in this case, being able to leverage some safety net when we see budgets that go up and down all the time for the entirety of the city, just today talking about roads or whatever the du jour is, if we kind of give in all the time for that for booking purposes, I've seen other organizations where you miss a booking or two and next thing you know, there are no bookings because that organization's done. So I think I can justify easily why we run kind of a carryover. Thanks for the presentation. It looks good. Good luck for 2015.
Thank you.
Others?
I'll make a comment. I am just very pleased with your leadership and the board and what you've done, and especially your partnership with the RDA and your surplus. I hope you're able to keep it in the future, and I thank Mr. Campion for stating that as well. This is a unique service that we provide free to the citizens and those others that are visiting here, and it's a class act. In terms of the economic impact, $6 million, I don't know how that's calculated, but it sounds pretty impressive. So just want to say thank you for your work and keep up the good work. And
thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right. Anyone else?
I was just going to say I was kind of hoping for a little guitar music with the presentation too, so I'm just,
have that back of the mind.
Background music.
Next year.
blew the opportunity. All right, well, thank you very much for an excellent report.
Thank you.
Next up, we have building safety, their 2014 departmental review.
Thank you, Council.
Yeah.
They said something separate.
Mr. Johnson, are you going to have music?
I don't want music.
No background music.
The bar's low.
Pink Panther.
I was just trying to.
I don't want him to be equitable in this way.
Thank you. Well, thank you for this opportunity. I'm sorry I didn't get that to staff in time to get that in the council. I was having a difficult time getting the report to be needed out of the RGD, so I can do that. Hopefully that addresses the issues and concerns that we have. I have no one else with me. My staff is really busy right now, so.
I knew that was going to come eventually.
Well played, sir.
I was going to bring my manager in there, but they're all working managers and developers.
Where's Roger?
Nice touch.
Basically, our department is broken down. It's broken down into four separate divisions: plan review, permit services, building inspections, housing inspections, and then our office services. And we have 26 full-time staff. In the 2015 budget, you approved another housing inspector position, which we haven't hired yet. We're still putting together the fee increase for that. That'll bring our total number to 27 full-time employees. We also utilize a summer permit clerk, which is usually a college student for architectural or engineering. And what they do is they deal with residential type permits with regard to like basement finishes, decks, additions, those type of things. Really frees up the time of the rest of the plan reviewers when they get very busy. So that's what we do for a permit clerk. We also have a part-time plumbing inspector that assists with our plumbing inspections. He's a retired plumber that has helped us over the last couple of years. We just found out that he's not planning on returning next year, so he will be able to remind next year for that. The next part of this is a statistical summary, which if you turn to page 3, it gives you a breakdown by construction permits. Total number of building permits that we issued in 2014 was 2,358 building permits for a total valuation of almost $400 million. Trade permits, we issued over 8,000 trade permits for a valuation of almost $100 million. So those numbers are very high. I mean, the valuation is the highest it's been in history that I'm aware of. If you consider inflation, it probably isn't the highest. But looking back 10 years, it hasn't been any higher than that. Inspections, last year we did 24,000. These are construction inspections, 24,680 inspections, which is a fairly large number for the work that we've been doing. Rental properties, the current snapshot right now is We have 4,637 rental buildings, which is over 14,600 units. So, and we inspect those every 2 years. So it's got to be a very large workload for us. That's why we approved that additional housing inspector last year. So far this year, new use rentals has, we have, or in 2014, we had 409 new use new buildings for about 512 rental units. Where most of our rental properties a year ago were in the single family dwelling range. People were converting houses into rental properties. Now we're turning into, we're seeing a lot more apartment buildings. We had most of our this year under construction, we have like Cuts Deep Park, the Boulders, Nicholas, Ashland Apartments, Meadows Apartments, Cascade Place, Meadow Lake, Woodland Park Apartments. So we are seeing a lot more apartment buildings. In line for review, we got the 501 on First, which is that large complex, Eastwood Ridge, and the Springs on 28th Street. So, plus we've had numerous meetings on Badger Hills, which is down near the new IBM, Circle Drive, West Circle Drive, the cottages, and then. It's just, we anticipate that there's going to be an increase in rental property of about 1,500 to 2,000 over the next couple of years. So. One of the other things we also deal with is complaints. We received approximately 650 complaints last year that we received and investigated. Any questions on the statistical report?
On your complaints, is there a trend? Do you have, you know, some that are slotted in specific categories?
With regard to the complaints, as far as, I mean, we kind of prioritize them if it's a life safety, if their utility's out, or if it's a tenant complaint, and they don't have their heat turned on in the winter, we try to deal with those as quickly as we can. Complaint about a neighbor's junk yard or junk vehicle, we try to fit that in with our workload with our rental housing inspectors when they have a chance. If they're in that area, they'll do a follow-up on that. So we try to do it efficiently, but we deal with the life safety ones in a more speedy process.
Thank you.
I'll just mention with the complaints, I hate to steal the IT's thunder, but that our website, if you notice, there's a new thing called a service request. Mm-hmm. So we're tied into that. So, I mean, we have two complaint types out there. We're building more of them as we're going along. So that will give us the ability to track the complaints and actually give them better statistics with the type of complaints and how quickly we respond to it. It also gives us the ability to interact with that citizen. So we'll send them a response back that says, this is where we're at with that, and they know what to expect. So it's there's a lot of improvements that the IT department's making with regard to the service requests.
When will that be available? Is it available now, or is it working?
It's available now. It went soft live about a week ago, and it's actually on the banner part of that. You'll see a little, I think it's a bell, and you click on that, and it'll take you to their website. You would sign in as a registered user, and then you get access to all the various types of complaints. Park and Rec is on it. Public Works is also on. We are in a couple other departments.
Thank you.
Yes. With regard to the second page of the handout, it's the expenditure and revenue summary. That would be the pages 4 and 5. 4 is our revenue, or expenditures, and then page 5 is our revenue. For 2014. Basically, our budgeted expenditures was $3,078,000. Our actual expenditures was $2,900,000. So we were 5.3% under budget. Our revenues were projected at $3,031,000, and our actual revenues was $3,800,000. So we tend to be kind of conservative when we project. To a projection on revenue, but we see that 60%. So construction activity is definitely coming.
You want questions now, or do you want to move through the entire report?
Pick his
I have a numbers question.
If you have some questions.
Well, this just illustrates my point from the prior discussion, because here, at least if I understand the numbers correctly, you came in with a surplus of around $163,000, which I believe would flow into the general fund. And we know that building safety has some distinct needs. We talk about development coordinators. We talk about some other things. So I'm just making the point of why wouldn't we allow building safety to keep those funds and use it for some of these needs that you've been articulating? Again, just a comment at this point.
And as Steve has, I mean, I think 2 years ago we encumbered some money with the revenues to help with the
sure.
system.
I'd like to help that going forward, Mr. Campy.
Just so the total difference is almost $1 million, right? You generated revenue in excess of $800,000.
Yes.
So, I mean, this tells me a little bit different story. It says we're doing a lot more work than we probably are prepared to do. We're taking a lot more revenue in than we projected.
Let's just say we're running a very lean department.
I mean, yeah.
Staffing levels should be higher for the construction work that they're doing right now. But yeah, we don't want to staff up too high because we don't want to be laying people off.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, immediately when I look at any budget, I see almost a 27% higher than expected column. I mean, you kind of start questioning what's going on. And this is just the boom, right, that we're in? Okay.
We've had some years where they haven't covered the expenses also.
Right.
And I guess in terms of the argument you're making, Randy, I would like to have some significant discussion about I would have some concerns about letting the departments share in any revenues that they might produce over above the budget. I mean, for instance, they're not all equal. You just had the music department. They actually had $12,000. You got the police department. They're pushing 300 and some thousand left over, thankfully. And all of that's needed to move into the. We need to keep our undesignated reserve sufficient. So I'd rather have that go into the undesignated reserve, and then you as a group take that, whatever we get to the point where you can take some money and put it into the CIP, do it that way rather than having each individual department try to fund their own CIP separately. So I would have some significant arguments against letting them individually share in any surpluses they might have. For instance, when the police department, again, I could budget much more closely and try to come down to a zero amount, but that runs the risk of running into the red, which also then endangers our credit rating. So we try not to get too much of a fine line because I do want those departments hopefully to close in the black, all of them. Theoretically, and we build up our non-designated reserve, and then you can use that after a certain amount to go back into capital improvements.
You know, and I think the undercurrent of my comments, and I'm just suggesting that as just one idea, but I think as we're starting to hear, and I really do value these 2014 reports, I think the undercurrent here is as we start to look at 2016, and we're hearing comments like we're $18 million a year underfunded on our street maintenance, and we have a police department that's looking at a substantial multi-million dollar request for a facility, and we're looking at a total staffing of in excess of 50 positions. I just think we're going to have to face some really tough questions as a council and get perhaps a little more creative in how we address some of those funding gaps. So that's the only reason I bring that up, because again, I think it's going to be a prelude to some difficult budget discussions this fall.
But hopefully you wouldn't use current operating monies to fund into the future operating. I mean, that's something that we've really avoided doing, and I think that's a very important fiscal objective, that you do not use current operating to fund future operating.
Right. Again, I'm just suggesting we're going to have to do business not the way we've done it in the past in terms of thinking more creatively. Otherwise, I have no idea how we're going to fund some of the budgeting requests that we expect to see for next year. None of us is going to be excited about increasing property taxes, so we're going to have to look at some other things. And I just want to start the discussion, you know, ahead of, you know, when we're sitting here those 3 days trying to figure it all out. So that's all. It's just a comment more than anything at this point. Mr. Bildebach.
I agree with Randy. I think we have to look at ways for departments to participate and help in
and the way we manage our money throughout the city. We get ripped periodically about people think we're spending money left and right. And I think it does open up the conversation. I think it's important to hear the conversation and have it. And I don't have a problem with having long discussions about it, because I think we have to figure out different ways and different methods on the way this city operates. We've watched cities operate the same way for a lot of years. We've also seen cities have some extremely painful financial experiences. And if we're going to stay out of those situations, we need to have those conversations.
Well, we've also had a AAA bond rating since 1977.
Right. I understand.
And we've had that because we haven't did any really fiscal tricks.
We need to make sure that everybody, we look at things differently and how things are done to make sure that we don't get ourselves in a position where we lose that AAA bond rating. And not looking or opening up and going beyond the boxes is not a way.
And I agree with that objective. I would not want us to get into things that might affect the way that we budget that lead us down the road towards losing that AAA bond rating.
But I think we have to be open to have discussions.
Yeah. Mr. Wojcik.
As much as it pains me to say that, I agree with what Mr. Quinfold's saying in terms of the operating. The discussion needs to happen. And I agree with that, and we do need to have that discussion. I think that the principles that he's stating are bedrock principles of responsible finance that we should not stray from. And I know that you guys aren't advocating for that anyways. I think the real issue, and where this is really an aside from this particular presentation, but I think the real issue and what I've taken exception with many times is the fact that, again and again, we're building infrastructure without having staff do the fiscal impacts beforehand. That's what's killing us. That's what got us $18 million in the hole, and those are the ones that I want to focus on.
I just think it's important for us not to be limiting ourselves in discussion. Discussion needs to happen. If it's good, it's good.
Yep.
But we still need to look at it. We still need to re-examine it. We still need to make sure that what we're doing today is the correct thing to keep this city out of trouble in the future. But if we don't, if we just accept it and say, oh, that's what it is, that's not being fair either. And I think, don't mean to take away from Randy's time, because I'm sure he'd like to tell us all about more things that are happening. But even when you look at Randy's department, the complaint end of it, there's no money generated from our people going out and looking at the complaints and going through this. And maybe these are things that we need to take looks at just to see. I'm not saying we have to change it, but I do think we do an injustice to the system and to our residents and our people of this city if we don't take looks at things. And just instead of taking, okay, they're fine, and let's go on, we need to take a look to make sure it still works and it makes sense.
And one more point, and I agree with that, and we're willing to have a more detailed discussion with you. But if you took his money from the surplus, and we're hoping that he has a surplus, because that funds everything else too. So you take that and use it just for Hearst Department, then you have to levy money on the other end of the situation also.
But I think
you have to realize that.
We should have. I mean, I think we need to look, again, at everything. And I think if we start saying, no, we're not going to look at this group or we're not going to look at this group, that's not a fair way to do this, and it's not fair for our citizens as well. We're taking dollars from every citizen, from all of us who live in this town, to fund projects. We need to give it the proper look at to make sure that it's still the appropriate way to do things.
And again, this, I don't want to presuppose a solution. Please don't misunderstand. This is underscoring that we just need to have some conversation at some point, Mr. Russell.
Well, I think you've said here recently to us, we've got to start putting everything on the table to figure out revenues and cutting expenses, and you come up with, you know, new utility tax and new, you know, streetlight utilities, all these different, you know, new taxes, and what we're trying to look at is say, and we're going to have to be more efficient, and are there ways here that we're seeing that we can look at to try to, when we put these things on the table, have these as also considerations on the table.
Everything is on the table except gimmicks. We'll leave that for the state.
All right. Mr.
I would just say, too, the one caveat to what's being discussed is I don't think that there's a one-size-fit-all here. To take a department that's capable of generating $800,000 worth of revenue and compare it with a department that can't generate any revenue and suggest that there's some way to retain, you know, the revenue you get to reinvest in your department, that just isn't how we work. There's differences between the departments. We need to embrace that and figure out how to work them as a unit, everyone together. And I'm sure that's what I'm hearing on this end. I just want to make sure we're looking at cohesively for the entire government here.
So how about that building safety department?
Keep firing.
You want to continue your report?
I'd like to make a point on the revenues. Our revenues exceeded our expenditures, but they should always do that because there's a lot of expenses that are not come directly out of our department.
Right.
We have HR services. We have IT services. We have IT staff that works full-time on a cell. That doesn't get charged back to my department. I do for computers, but not for that IT support. Yes. So there's a lot of other additional expenses that should be. So, building safety department should always be in the black because it should help cover those additional expenses that are associated.
I'm glad you think so.
All right. Well, sorry to camp on your time. No. We'll let you continue.
I will just get into the challenges and the opportunities that I've dealt with. One of the big items that we've dealt with has been the code change. The state of Minnesota has been trying to adopt the 2012 international codes for quite some time now, and they finally completed that, or they're almost done with that process. It's been a number of controversial issues that created delays and sporadic effective dates. For example, and I listed them, January 24th, the building code, the elevator code, conservation code, accessibility code, mechanical code, and fuel gas code all went into effect on January 24th. February 14th, we had the residential energy code and then the radon code. And then on June 2nd, we have the Minnesota building code, which is a commercial, and then also the commercial energy code. So the issues that we've been struggling with is we have conflicts now between various codes, plus the timing of everything, and the adoption process. By state statute, there was supposed to be a 180-day wait period from the adoption to the effective date. With the commercial building code, they adopted it 2 months, and then now it's effective on June 2nd. So they have a two-month period, which created a big fine for our designers, and it created a lot of issues with us with regard to not even knowing what the state amendments were. So, we spent a lot of time this last year and the beginning of this year dealing with that code change. I understand there's legislation in the process to actually make that 180-day be a real 180-day and to turn into a six-year code cycle. So then they're going to mandatorily be every 6 years they'll go through an update. It's not only learning the 2012 code, we had to learn the 2009 code because we missed that code process. So there's been a lot of issues with regard to the code change that has been a lot of work for us. One of the things that's in the residential building code is sprinkling of all attached single-family dwellings, which are townhomes and houses over 4,500 square feet. That's going to hit about 10% of our property, of our single-family dwellings that we issue. So we have to try to track those. There's multiple systems. They can go with the standalone sprinkler system, or we're seeing a lot of multi-purpose systems where it's actually tied to the plumbing system. So now we have to do an additional review of those plumbing drawings because it's an engineered system. Plus, we have to track it, provide additional inspections and additional tracking information. So it's those little things have created a lot of work for us with regard to those code changes. Another code change that's really hit us is if you have an engineered floor system like I-joists or engineered trusses, and you have an unfinished basement, you don't have to sheetrock that floor because the fire hazard that's there. So how do you deal with that? How do you make sure that what's underneath that sheetrock has been inspected? So we've been working with the Rochester Builders. This has really led into a lot of educational opportunities. We teamed up with the Rochester Builders to do seven lumberyard meetings this spring. And at each lumberyard meeting, there's probably 35 to 45 contractors and builders that were meeting with us, and we were going through the various code provisions. So it's been very good for us to get out there and try to get in front of this, but it's been very difficult because we really didn't know what the code was as of January 1st. We didn't really know what the final state of that code. So, like I said, it's been creating a lot of extra work for us and a lot of issues with regard to that. We're also going through our staffing levels. We lost a couple of chief inspectors this last year with regard to retirements. And when you lose that knowledge base, it takes a little while to get that back up to speed. So that created a kind of a chain reaction with our department and some promotions and left some vacancies in our rental housing. So we've hired two new housing inspectors in our rental because of the changes that took place. So plus there's training with all that. So we really should be requesting more people. we, with over 50 people being requested next year, I didn't feel that we should add on to that. We're going to take a wait and see approach and hope to deal with the two overtime and part-time employees, knowing that if we continue at the same pace, we're going to come back fairly soon and ask for additional time. But we want to make sure that we can actually support that position and not and keep them busy before we do that. Technology, we're continuing to move forward with implementation of our Acela system. Technology is always a struggle. It's been a kind of an issue that we've been working with. They're constantly changing the program. They're updating it twice a year, so we have to continue to do those updates. We just finished a major upgrade earlier this year with Acela, and now we have the ability to use contact management and actually get the public users set up. We had Acela come out for a two-day. They came out on their own at their dime to do a two-day with us to kind of steer us through those changes, and we're hoping to get that implemented here fairly soon. We have made some great strides with improving our customer service with regard to Acela. One of the items that the builders wanted was email notifications. Well, we always had the email notification for the inspection result. We now created one for inspection confirmation. So if they schedule an inspection, they'll send them an email confirming that they have an inspection. They wanted to be able to track their subcontractors, electrical, plumbing, and mechanical. So now every time we schedule a result in inspection on an electrical permit, it sends an email to that building contractor. Gives him the ability to track his project better. Gives him the ability to schedule his inspections when he needs it. So, I mean, we've had a lot of great praise with regard to those items. So we are making some good changes there. They don't affect the whole process. It's not exactly what we want. I mean, it doesn't do everything we want to do, but it is moving forward. We are, like I said, we're teamed up with the Rochester Builders. In fact, tomorrow I think we have a thing called Broad's Builders and Building Safety, where the RAB is hosting a lunch where our inspectors and our staff will go be available for interaction, be available to answer any questions with regard to the new code, those type of issues. So we feel that collaboration has been working very well, and we want to continue that. Space needs. One of the things that we're doing is we're running out of space. If you've ever been to our office, we see all those file folders, address folders that go back to the 30s and 40s. With the city implementation of the LaserFiche system, we are working on an interface between Acela and LaserFiche so that when we attach some permit, we're going to have auto-attach the permits, attach the applications. So our hope is, in the next month, is not to generate any more paper. Everything would be electronically attached to Acela, which would ultimately be in LaserFiche. So we won't need to expand on internal filing within our office. That's one of the items that I'm probably going to come back in the 2016 budget is for a wide scale or a wide format scanner, so that we can scan the plans and get those into the system. Because not everyone has them digitally. Not everyone has those plans in the digital format to where they can send it to us. So we're going to have to scan some of those. The other thing is the backfile scanning of it. We need to free up some space in our office to do that. So. We're in the process of getting bids for hiring companies or hiring part-time staff to do some back file scanning to get that all back up on the LaserFiche, get rid of the paper. So those are some big projects that are coming forward. We're trying to come up with the best plan before we actually present you the details of what that's going to cost. With that, I'm open up to any additional questions.
And I don't want to digress too much here, but do you recall offhand what our annual support amount is for the Acela software?
I think it's about $60,000 now.
60?
Yep, and we transfer, planning and zoning pays about 15% of that, and the fire department pays about 10%.
And do you know, does Acela have the equivalent of a user group or some gathering of like users?
They do.
Do we ever participate?
Yes, well, we did last year. It was in San Diego, and Ann Hayden and Jesse Tabor, who are the IT staff that work with Acela, and myself attended that last year, and then Jennifer Gardner from the company. This year it's in Los Angeles. It's very expensive, and
Well, two comments. One, I've always been under the impression that Acela, I don't have a problem with the software, but I've been under the impression that we're not leveraging as much as we could, perhaps due to staff time. One side comment is for $60,000 a year, I would hope they'd come out and help us out a little bit. That's just my comment. But beyond that, I would encourage us to participate in those opportunities. If maybe we can learn from some others, you know, some tips, tricks, whatever, and how to use the software. So just a comment.
There is an Acela community, and we are interacting with that.
All right.
An online community where we are asking questions.
Okay, Mr. Campion.
To piggyback on that, I would say I recently had a request from a resident that was looking to get a new home built, and it led me to the online tool for building safety, and I thought it was great. I mean, maybe there were a little bit rough edges, and I'm a computer geek, so I figured it out, but I thought it worked pretty well to, you know, here's where it is, this is the comments you got back. So it kind of eliminates a little bit of the mystery between what the builder might be telling the client and what building safety is telling the builder. Sometimes that isn't always a clear communication channel. So if you show the person who's paying the bills, you know, this is what the comments were, then it kind of puts the onus back on the development, you know, to make sure it's going well. So I found it to be really useful.
Yeah, and I'm no complaint with the software. I just think there's probably even more.
Right.
That
yeah. Absolutely.
There definitely is. So okay, others. Ms. Means, you have a question.
Again, I just wonder about the space request and the scanning option that's available. Now, if you could scan those documents, it would free up that space.
Yeah,
that's what you're in the process of doing.
That's what our problem. I mean,
so then, will you still need the space, or how long will it take to get that project completed?
One of the estimates for doing the back file scanning was about a 6 month period. We could hire a part-time person and do it over the next 6 years, probably. But I mean, we're looking at the best cost. I mean, the best option here. So we're kind of weighing that out right now. One of the things we need to do is I call it stop the bleeding, stop creating more paper, because it causes more work for us. If we can eliminate that and get that directly attached into the Acela system, and because we are required by state law to retain permit applications and permits. Definitely. So there's certain retention that we have to keep. So we want to make sure we get that into the system. But if we can eliminate that so it auto-attaches that permit and we scan that application, we don't need to file that. We just save time for filing, which helps us with staff doing processing and permits. So we're working through some efficiencies right now. But the key there was that interface with LaserFiche. We're still working on the integration. They're still working on some of the setup of the LaserFiche. So we're right there. They were doing some testing this weekend, I think, on trying to convert everything from our Acela document server over to the LaserFiche. So and I think things are going pretty well with that. So.
Mr. Woodrick, then Mr. Ruskin.
So the LaserFiche name, is that, I mean, that had a different connotation, I think, years ago, but basically it's just a digital storage platform.
Yep.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I imagine that the... A couple students with a scanner and a couple hard disk drives is probably a lot cheaper than new facilities. So
we're not
like
looking
a,
for new facilities.
Yeah,
we're just trying to free up some space within that.
And I mean, so is this the kind of thing where do you need to bring in experts to handle this, or is this something that can be kind of work that we can handle with some interns?
I think we could do it with interns.
I mean, I just like to see that. I believe in aggressive digitization of everything anyway. So and then my other question was the a little bit back to the rental inspections. Are we able to keep up with the rental inspections when we've got 14,600 over a 2-year cycle? Are we able to get out there and do them all, or I mean, are we falling behind?
No, we are able to do that. What we can do is build some efficiencies in here to where we pre-schedule, and we're working on this on the larger complexes where we can pre-schedule and get it so that we can provide a team of inspectors out there. Instead of one or two inspectors, we'll provide a team of 3 or 4 inspectors, and we can get those
And is Acela able to do a lot of the same kind of notifications, confirmations of the inspection on the inspection side as well, on the rental?
On the rental?
On the rental permits.
Yeah, and right now we're having a difficult time struggling with some of the contact, the way it was. The way the rental housing was set up, it's, let's say it was an old antiquated system, the way it was set up. So we're once we work through this public user interface to get that set up, we're going to go and redesign our rental to interact with that. Once we have that, then we have the access to those email addresses. But yes, we can right now, but yeah, it's not very efficient.
And then can people, regardless of the function, can people request inspections through Excella at this point online?
Not yet.
Not yet, but that's something we're moving towards?
That's what we're moving towards.
Okay.
The first hurdle is getting the public user to be able to access just their records. Once they get into that, then we can turn on those other features of inspections and inspection calendars.
Okay.
Mr. Ruska.
Mr. Jones, how many years have you been since you were department head?
I think
I remember when you kind of stepped into that position, we were looking, and I just think you've done a really good job. I appreciate your work on it. I think your outreach to the builders and making yourself more accessible and helping explain has gone a long way to helping. You know, in the past, it seemed like there's a lot of issues, and those issues seem to be minimized now, and I think it's a lot of work based on what I've seen out of your department and people that are kind of understanding how to communicate better and help those people to understand that. So I really appreciate your work on it. I think your vision about holding off on staffing, you know, this business really ebbs and flows. I remember a few years ago, everybody was saying, how come we don't lay people off from building safety? Because we have all these, there's not any building going on, and there's not any inspections to be done. You know, I mean, it does ebb and flow, and I like your idea of trying to get through with some part-time, some overtime, some things like that. I think that could benefit us in the long run. So again, I think that's a great management strategy. But talk, just kind of tie in that hiring, how does HR do the hiring for you to get you down to like a few candidates? Do you have any input in that? You're hiring several people and you say experience, you know, things are different. Those are key components to hire, and you know, keeping your staff efficient is getting good qualified people. Are you finding good people? Is the HR do all the staff hiring for you, or do you have input on that, or how exactly does that
work? We do the hiring ourselves.
Good.
The applications we all get in, put into NeoGov, and then we work with the HR specialists to kind of determine the scoring for that. So based on how they answer various questions, they give us a scoring as far as the ranking of the candidates, and from there we have to interview the based on the scoring.
And you do that with you and your lead management team?
Yeah, whoever's... we've been working with Susan on that one because it's hiring for her department.
And that'd be hired soon, you think, on that?
We've already hired two people, yeah. But those are replacements.
Right.
So
the same position.
We're kind of going down farther into the candidate list. We're at the point where do we just close it, reward it, and then reopen it to try to get some more interested candidates or not.
But so, so quality isn't exactly maybe where you want to see it at this point.
No, I mean... everyone's getting busy now. A while back, you could get experienced inspectors. Mm-hmm. You're having a difficult time finding experienced inspectors.
Yes, that's kind of what. Okay, thank you.
All right, anyone else? Well, thank you very much. Again, we'll be looking forward to the conversation in the fall. All right, we have two additional topics this afternoon. Next up is the Game Haven Park Master Plan. And we do have the extensive presentation in front of us, so... Mr. Nigber, maybe you want to highlight it for us?
I'll keep it brief. In doing so, though, I need to make some acknowledgments here. Andy Maskell is the design consultant on this master plan. Jeff Robertson from RASC and Elmsley County provided some funding for us to make this master plan happen. And without those participation, those partnerships, this would not have gone forward where it is right now. We'd be at least another year away before that happened. The master plan really started about 3 or 4 years ago, a little longer than that, in a search for a location to do some mountain biking. And it's blossomed beyond that because of the location that was selected for this, with the Boy Scout camp being right next door, and the topography of the area, the growth of the location with additional property purchases in the past couple of years has all helped in that area. So, again, so the numbers we just talked about there. When we went through this property, you know, we looked at the areas that were beneficial, the topography, the location with Boy Scout camp, who our partnerships are in that area right now. We've got Public Works up there doing maintenance. We've got you folks providing funding out there. We've got Hampshire County doing some work out there for us. Our staff is out there doing work. And again, DNR is doing in the fisheries area, helping us out there. So again, a great partnership already exists on this location. So again, expanding upon this was real key. In doing so, we made an application this past year for the Legacy Commission, Green Rivers and Parks and Trails Commission, to look at this designated regional park. And the concept we had out there for this master plan we're working on right now, but they said, what a great idea. We're going to fund it. We're going to be adopted as a regional park in the state's eyes. And in doing so, it opens up a revenue stream that would not be possible otherwise. That's through legacy funding. This park, along with Cascade Lake and Quarry Hill, were the three designated for Southeast Minnesota. Out of 90 submitted, we were in the top 20, those three parks. In our park planning here, we looked at having a park that was balanced in nature, having a unique variety of activities, improving the recreational activities out in the air for and being accessible to all, helping getting people healthier, that's a key component for the county funding, and that's sustainability, ecologically as well as financially. The vision we have for the park is going to be a place that provides a range of recreational amenities, activities all year long, in a beautiful natural setting that offers authentic, sustainable, healthy, fun experiences for Southeast Minnesota residents of all ages and abilities. Again, that's key from a county funding standpoint as far as being our mission for Park and Rec. The property you're looking at here, I'm just going to point on the screen here. The majority of the property we currently own and operate, it covers about 360 acres right now. We're looking at acquiring some additional land areas. This primary piece right here is a 95-acre tract. We have looked at some other properties along with that. This current parcel is a willing seller in their property currently. There may be others that may come forward in the future, but this is the first one that came about. And as part of that, not wanting to go through eminent domain to acquire property needed for a park activity, we said, what can we work with in this property? In doing this, we have gone through and skip ahead here, and looked at providing about 7 miles of mountain biking trails, 10 miles of hiking trails, a 2 mile paved trail all the way around the entire lake, which is unique around here in this area, a bike skills course, a future chalet, snow tubing, etc. These are all some ideas that we had talked about before we had the master planning effort done. The Frisbee Golf Course came out of the master planning effort as a good population driven activity. Those that attended the meetings, the outreach meetings, said this, you should look at this more in depth, and we've done so, and we have included this as part of the master planning effort. So summer activities you see on the screen right there, the fishing, the kayaking, archery, things like that. Most of the activity happens in the north half of the park. We abut 45th Street on the very north side, which is about a half a mile east of the Target Main Street development. So that's pretty good access. There's also a program right now to get better access through a bike plan, a bike path process on the north side of 45th Street with Public Works. The intent here is to expand the facility and utilize the north half of the property for most of the activities. Again, a snow tubing hill, the mountain biking activities, the terrain park, the bike skills course area, a natural playscape location, expansion and change of location of the archery range are all in this north half. What will happen in the south half, which is kind of southwest where the dam is, a paved trail that goes around the lake, and additional mountain biking courses, as well as habitat restoration. Winter activities, the snow tubing, the cross-country skiing, et cetera, is all happening in the wintertime. And we looked at, as part of the master planning, separating both the mountain biking trails as well as the cross-country trails. And the decision was to keep two separate trail systems out there because, again, fat tire biking is becoming a real key activity in wintertime. Gets people back on the mountain biking trails, separated from our cross-country ski trails so they aren't damaged by that. Again, the winter activities kind of see the north end there. One key activity we're looking at for Game Haven as well as Cascade Lake and Quarry Hill is a natural playscape area, getting these kids back to nature, utilizing the natural materials, stones, rocks, water, sticks, etc. Just in not structured play, kind of back when I was a kid, we'd go play in the woods for the day, and that's what we did. We played with sticks and stones and threw sticks at kids and all kinds of fun things. So, part of my character, I guess. But I think it's a key factor in getting kids back to nature, which is real needing this time of year and for this population we have. A key activity in this park area we're looking at is wetlands activities. Right now, Public Works is working with SCH on wetlands creation out here on the south half of the property. You may recall, we purchased 150 acres from the Cook family in the last several years. And as part of that, through those 150 acres as well as some existing reservoir property, we're going to create upwards of about 100 acres of wetlands and wetlands buffers, which is a really great asset for our local population here. Creating wetlands as well as our local use for wetlands mitigation on our projects, whether it's road projects or impact for a building project, you name it, we can utilize these banked wetlands. And again, you can't see down here, but there's mountain biking trails that will be woven throughout here as well as the paved trail around this location. Kind of a challenge the way the layout currently is, but we're working with Public Works on that activity. The challenging part, you heard about the discussion already, the livability standards that we provide for parks and arts and things like that, the challenges for funding, the uniqueness that we have out here. This park is expensive. We've got some big key activities here that will cost a lot of money. land acquisition, the multi-purpose trail on the entire lake, the snowmaking capabilities, and the chalet are the four big components that cost a lot of money. But these are all a long-term vision for this park. And I say long-term, could be a 10-year process. In the meantime, though, there's funding streams that would be available for us through Legacy. Once we adopt a master plan here, get your blessing on it, get the park's blessing we already talked about with that, it makes it eligible for funding with $8.1 million statewide pot of money available for us. Whether we can get some of that or all of it or a portion of that is up for our application process, but we'd be sure going for that with both Cascade Lake, Quarry Hill, and this park here. These functions that we're talking about in this master plan for the cost is laid out that it can be done in phases, in portions of phases, or even subcomponents based on what funding we have available for us. Right now, we have RAS that does a lot of maintenance for us and a lot of trail building for us. That would hopefully continue. They're a great partner of ours. Our staff can go out there and assist in that activity. We may have some fundraising efforts. Legacy funding, for example, would be in there. And we'll look for CIP funding to help support this activity. The cash in lieu from a CIP standpoint will help leverage, I think, that's the legacy monies. So again, some minor amount of money we can put in from a city standpoint may help generate additional monies from the state. Where we're at in the process right now, the master plan has been approved by the park board and reviewed. We've actually had joint powers board reviewed and approved this as well at their May meeting. We've had several community engagement processes, public open houses that some of you have attended. Facebook websites have been submitted some information out there to get additional comments and input. We're coming before you now, and again, some of you have seen this through our promotional information before, and again, looking for your concurrence on this master planning effort. Additionally, we're looking to get your concurrence on designating this property as a park as well. That will change how this is managed to some extent, but still preserve the flood control activities that are out there right now. This master plan is necessary for funding, as I talked about earlier on. We've got a submittal deadline, we believe it's July or June 30th. The Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails Commission has set that up, and we'll submit that this master plan through them. Once they've accepted this master plan, we'll make eligible for funding starting in August. And we'll make that request in August, and hopefully we can fund it for some money next year. With that, it's a very brief presentation for you.
And I should mention, as a member of the Joint Powers Board, we had a chance to see this in detail and ask a lot of questions. It was positively received there. So,
yes.
I'm sorry, Mr. Ruska?
Just want to, I think, you know, this is something that it's kind of new to Rochester, but I think it's really, you know, in our world of amateur sports nowadays, we see a lot more of this kind of activity and recreation being demanded and enjoyed. And we really, in my eyes, it's an underserved area of our community. We don't really have anything in this area. And you know, 10 years ago, I think we all laughed at the X Games when that kind of came out. We're like, really? You know, but look at it now. And I think that that kind of stuff is really growing. And to be able to create health and recreation in an area that's a natural habitat like this is just really exciting. I like you say, we've got a lot of things to do still, but to have this area here to capitalize on and to build on, I think is going to be a really great deal. I'd like to acknowledge the what we call the other RASC, the Rochester Active Sports Group, and the work that they've done with this. I've met with them a few times, and their plans and their vision and their effort in this has been, I think, critical to get it to where it is today. So we appreciate everything that they're doing on that. One thing that I kind of wonder about down the road is, are we going to have any kind of staffing or any kind of people located out there? Because, you know, whenever you put something like this together to get people to understand the rules, the usage areas, and things like that, have we thought that out and determined kind of how that's going to move forward?
We have thought that out. In fact, Jeff and I have talked, and other RAS members have talked about that activity. At some point in time, this is going to grow beyond our capabilities. We'll have to have permanent staffing to help support the maintenance and trails out there, as well as operate the winter activities, namely the snow tubing and the snowmaking equipment. I mean, our staff alone right now cannot manage that. We'll need additional staffing. Again, that comes on with funding questions and where that will come from as well.
And you have the DNR is going to look at, you know, additional maybe stocking or management of the water.
That's correct, yep. Yeah. Yep. They've already committed to that. It's a matter of once we get this more up and running, they're doing it right now, and they'll do more of it.
Yeah, like I said, great opportunity for our area, and I hope it continues to grow and develop, but appreciate all the work that everybody's put into it. It's exciting.
Mr. Hickey, then Mr. Campion.
So obviously, you know, as a regional park, it's kind of a big departure from a traditional city park. And I can kind of see, you know, through legacy funds or whatever else, or maybe the capital dollars come from, but just trying to understand the operational cost of this. We're talking about snowmaking and the chalet and tubing. I mean, you know, operationally, how's that going to work with operational funds?
My expectation of this is, and right now there's no cost involved with operations because, again, we don't know when that will actually happen. Well, before we do make that investment, we'll know what those operational costs will be. That being said, we look at having a stream of revenue coming in as part of it, that the activity to support that operation, whether it's a fee per day, fee per week, an annual subscription to go use that snowmate equipment area. The snow tubing, for example, will be a daily basis, for example. The real details, I don't know. And again, you're right, legacy dollars provides the capital, but not the operational dollars.
I could add something to that. If we look at some of the city's parks that office the winter tubing hills and terrain parks and so forth, they've found through the tubing hill and the revenues from tubing hill and terrain park cover the whole cost of the snowmaking, the annual cost of the snowmaking. So once you get the population coming out the tube and all, it pays for itself. At least that's been their history.
Okay, thank you.
Right now, there's three courses up in Minneapolis that do snowmaking. And again, we're kind of isolated now here, so again, it's a great opportunity for us.
Okay, Mr. Campion.
Oh, I just wanted to say, I think on the surface, it's great that we've got the phases broken out because I think it gives a clear kind of agenda for the spending. The second piece is I love the idea of a park that's different than what we have, because one of the things we deal with is the sustainability of building these jungle gyms and all the equipment that needs that constant maintenance, right, that you need to do the turf mowing, you need to take all these maintenance costs into effect, and then to see that natural habitat, which I just can picture my three-year-old bolting for that as soon as we open the door, and not having that be a significant difference to him between a jungle gym and piling a few rocks on top of each other. That's the beauty of kind of these different style of parks. And I just look at this and I go, this is the sort of kind of breath of fresh air we need as an option for the park opportunities inside of our area. And I think this looks really exceptional. I'm really excited about our opportunity out here.
Mr. Wagner.
Hi. Too, I'm looking for the opportunity for my kids to get out and throw sticks at people. So, I was
just throw sticks at people.
Oh, just throw sticks. All right. I've been following the downtown east development in Minneapolis, and one of the interesting things that I got out of that is that you know, with their plans starting to come to completion, the park board is going to go out and try and raise $20 million privately. And I guess my question is, how exactly are they doing that, and how do we get in on some of that action?
Well, kind of to the fundraising activities, right now we're going through a master plan, thanks to your funding. Yeah. We started that here relatively soon. We've got proposals in right now, we're reviewing, and my anticipation will approve something for park board at the July meeting for a consultant to go forward with. As part of that master planning effort, we'll look at what the revenue streams might be for that, and a friends group or a fundraising activity might be part of that.
Okay.
It might also be a bonding request, or it might be some other activity, some creative method. We don't know yet.
And the other question I had is, I mean, this is obviously a fabulous park, and I'm fully supportive of going more towards the regional parks. I think it's a better community investment than these little five-acre things all over town that are really expensive to maintain and sometimes minimally useful. But what this particular park location is great for the 60% of Rochester citizens who can drive to a park, and offers almost no access for those that choose not to drive, can't drive for health reasons, or are too young to drive. And that's one of my concerns about this entire area, is there is absolutely no bicycle connectivity to this part of the community. And well, how are we going to solve that?
Well, there's two options right now. And I mentioned the 45th Street bike path is being proposed, I think, for next year. On the north side of 45th, one option, Target. Again, yep. Target's kind of isolated by itself.
Yep. Can't get there.
But we're also looking at submitting for some bonding requests to take a bike trail all the way north to, say, Willow Creek Middle School, thereabouts, to make that connectivity happen. But again, we are looking at different options.
Are we in contact with the current owner of the old rail bed about...
We're not currently. We had been in the past. It was owned a lot by Seneca, and their pumping lines, and I think now they turn that back to the private owners. They retain some rights for pumping their spray field areas. So I'm not sure who actually owns the land itself. Do we put bike path up? That'd be a good location.
I mean, I don't know if there's another way that really works between here and there.
We have seen different locations in that same corridor as part of the use that the rail corridor, some that not use the rail corridor. Okay. And again, it's a matter of topography and land access and getting underneath Highway 52. Okay.
I mean, it's just an ongoing concern that the south end of Rochester is so poorly connected to everything else right now.
Public Works and Parks is well aware of that, and hopefully we can resolve that at some point in time. Otherwise, it might be like 18th Avenue Southwest is another alternative to bring people out that direction from the bike trails.
Oh, my God.
Different way to go around.
That would be a long ride up a big hill.
It's a great system along the Zumbro, and that there's a lot of new homes out there that are not connected to.
So. That's right. Yeah.
All right, anyone else?
So tonight you'll see a request out there for adoption of the master plan for yourself and then designation as a park.
Right, all right, Ms. Meadens.
Just one quick question. The public schools, you know, they have like a 30 or 35% poverty rate or free and reduced lunch. Mm-hmm. So do you have anything to connect those students so they can experience this kind of regional park? Is that on County 1?
This park, there's no programming specifically for this park itself. Poor Hill, one of our other regional parks that we're looking at here, does do program with the school district to get kids out in that park. Again, it's nature-based as well, different types of nature, but it's more the educational side. So school does go to that park quite often.
And I can see in time that this could be. I mean, it's not even hardly established now. I can see bus trips out there
That's
and
right.
the experiences and things.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely.
That's good.
All right.
Thank you. All right, our last item for this afternoon, discussion of the 65th Street and 34th Avenue Northwest intersection. Who is leading us through this one? Richard?
Back in 2013, the council entered into an agreement with MnDOT to construct the 65th Street interchange. And just again, because I know your time is short today, I'll just refer you to page 3. And note there's an item that's circled there. And then I'll actually ask you to turn back the page.
Can I get a copy of that to be involved with you? Wait for the record to get
one extra
of a property order on 65th Street.
Okay. So in paragraph 2.2, there's the city will evaluate the level of service at the 34th Avenue 65th Street intersection a minimum of once every 2 years following the opening of the interchange. The city will relocate 34th Avenue and close the existing connection 65th within 2 years of meeting any one of the following thresholds. Threshold 1 through 7 are all technical criteria. Crash rates, delay, level of service degradation, queue lengths on the off-ramp, all things that can be measured that are things that would contribute to an unsafe intersection. And that MnDOT would have authority for which to close it, okay? And things that are typically seen as part of an intersection evaluation on when a modification is made. The very last one, which is circled, is the one that your audience is here to speak to you about tonight. And it's totally arbitrary, totally unrelated to anything related to safety. It's that the intersection will be closed no later than seven years after it's open. Not based on anything other than time. And it was a condition, and the fact that it's listed number 8, its relevance was the fact that it was added at the very last point of negotiations by MnDOT. As it circulated through their department, both locally and probably in St. Paul for review, I said, well, let's just throw this 8th one in there because we really don't want that interchange to begin with. And this is one way for us to make sure that the intersection operates at its highest efficiency regardless of all the other technical criteria, we're just going to have to make the city close it after 7 years. This is the second document that this existed, that this condition existed. The first one was the Memorandum of Understanding that was negotiated in 2010 as we completed the six-year study of the need for the interchange and the operational benefits of it. That Memorandum of Understanding, depending on which attorney you talk to, was not legally binding or was legally binding, depending on who you talk to. But this is legally binding because it's part of an agreement with the state. So this is the issue. And I've met with the property owners on several occasions over the past several years to discuss strategies about how to work through this. One of the other conditions here was that the city had to adopt an official street map showing how the connection from 34th Avenue over to 37th Avenue would be facilitated. Again, there was the Planning Commission and you decided on a route that goes south of the church and not north of the church. That's a separate issue that needs to be addressed, but probably not today. We've talked about engaging Senator Senjum in the discussion, which we have. We've talked about engaging the former chief engineer for MnDOT, who some of you may remember came down to facilitate a mediation session between us and MnDOT over this very issue. He's volunteered his time to meet with MnDOT to try to get them to reconsider this. My latest conversations with both communications with both Senator Senjum and with this former MnDOT employee who's now in the private sector is that MnDOT is not interested in changing this. My personal feeling is that this has to be something that's changed from the top down. It isn't going to change from the bottom up. In other words, and I guess to put it quite frankly, I don't think the city council has much leverage with MnDOT right now. So that's what I've been trying to do, is find out where that leverage might be. And I think that leverage comes from the top down. It comes from either within MnDOT at central office or from the legislature. Gary will remember the, I think, three consecutive years that we introduced legislation to get the interchange funded or approved. We actually agreed that we would pay for it, as we did. And we made it all the way in front of various legislative committees in the transportation, both at the House and the Senate. And they basically told us to go back and work it out because the legislature wasn't there to resolve disputes between local agencies and state government, such as this. So we're kind of back to where we were. We now have the interchange built, and they want us to change this access. And again, there's no basis for that condition number 8 other than they were in a strong position to negotiate and they included it. So that's kind of where we are, and again, we've been trying to work behind the scenes. I met with many of the property owners that are here on at least 2 occasions over the past year or so, and we haven't been successful in trying to, again, work through Senator Senjum and others to make it happen. So I think they're here today to maybe talk to you about what other actions they would like to see.
Questions from the three?
What was the, what, do you know what they're using for the date of open?
It would be the fall of 2013, I believe. So we're coming up on the second anniversary here.
Okay, so the 7 years would expire fall of 2020 is what we're looking at.
Good math.
Yes.
Just want to add it all together.
Yeah, roughly.
Trust your math.
So we're not obligated to do it now.
Correct. But understand that that process will take a while. A frontage road needs to be constructed across property owned by the Word of Life Church. The church has indicated they do not have any money to build the roads, even though they were shown in their general development plan. There is property that's being has been acquired at this particular intersection of 34th that, again, potentially impacts a frontage road connection. There's a difference of opinion between the business owners on 34th Avenue as to where that frontage road should be. I think the majority of them supports the location that was not selected by the council as far as the official map. They prefer the northerly most, so that the east-west connection, if it was constructed, would be more of a frontage road instead of something that would be far south of the church. So there's, like I say, I think the whole location of the frontage road issue is one thing. From, I think, the property owner's perspective here today, that's an issue that they'd rather you not spend any time talking about now. They'd rather you get this condition removed. I think the impacts of the comp plan have a significant impact on when the other seven triggers in here, if you will, could become effective, because if the development of what we've referred to as the Northwest Territories, that area north of 65th Street, is slowed or not encouraged by the comp plan update, it's less likely that these other seven triggers would occur. And if they were to occur, they'd be a lot farther out in the future as to when we would start seeing levels of service degradation. So in essence, what I'm saying is that basically the vacant parcels south of Menards would be all that would, else that would be developed in this area other than the vacant lots within the particular subdivision here on 34th. That's under one scenario that the planning department is looking at for the comp plan. If the whole Northwest Territory was developed, 35,000 people added in that area over an extended period of time, a lot of more commercial development and activities, these other criteria are going to come into play sooner than later.
So, and I don't want to overcomplicate this, at least for today's discussion, it seems like the first seven conditions are relatively tangible. They have a basis in solid rationale. The eighth condition, in my lingo, is just because.
It can also be measured, but it's just because.
Right.
Just because it's 7 years.
So if we as a council somewhat agree with that, you know, it would be good legislatively to see if we could remove that eighth condition to, in fact, you know, any improvement in that intersection is really based on rational data that drives that decision as opposed to just some arbitrary time limit. And if we agree that's the best approach to try to work legislatively to get that corrected, is that the action you're suggesting?
I think yes, but I think it's also probably going to come back to you that until you've made an effort, and I think that would be in the form of a letter from you, a resolution, and a letter from the council saying we want reconsideration of this condition. Until you've done that, I don't think you'll probably get the legislative support to do it. Because the legislature will say, well, what have you done on your own to try to get this to happen? So I think we have to go through those processes.
Understood. Mr. Campion.
Yeah, so one of the, Kyle Kettering is here today, and he reached out to me, I think probably because my name popped up as a new city council member for the area. And I met with him on a couple occasions, or at least one occasion, to talk about this. And I think that's part of what I'm kind of looking to make sure I'm up to speed on, the summary of the situation. I think we're up to speed. I did find some documentation, went through the public meeting notes that happened relative to, I think it's like August 10th, 2010. Let me make sure I get the right date. April 8th, 2010. And it looks like on some of the documentation at that point, we were already talking about potentially closing access. But I kind of agree that, I mean, it's very clear. I won't call it punitive because that's probably not fair. But this last measure is certainly outside the scope of, you know, any engineering standard. It's just 7 years. And I think it's like it's overly burdensome on both the property owners and the community. You know, I would be in wholehearted support of making sure we get a letter, you know, say, resolving that we'd like to see them reconsider it. I don't know if the rest of the council would do that. I'd be wholly supportive of that.
And I'd be willing to draft that letter and have it on your next agenda for you to adopt it by resolution and forward that on.
Others?
I'm fine doing that. We've been trying to get street utilities approved at the legislative level for 20 years, so I don't think that our statement's going to help a whole lot, but I mean, at least it gets rid of this one particular condition. I think the bigger thing is that, you know, there are some other conditions in here that very well could be met before that time frame as well, depending on the businesses that go in up there. It's not that hard to get to the warrants for a four-way stop out there, and I would suspect that might happen within the seven-year time frame anyway. It really depends on what type of business is going up there, but we'll buy you a little bit of time, but it's going to be a little bit of time.
So just to be clear, it's a letter to MnDOT as an interim step before we try to do the legislative fix.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
I think that's a step we have to take.
Yeah.
We were trying to work through Senator Senjum. He was on the council back during the discussions of the interchange, had intimate knowledge about a lot of this, just seeing that he could influence them, get some favorable sense from them that they were willing to do this, and the response I got back was that they aren't interested in changing it. So I think we've got to now back up, take that step, formally make a request.
So it sounds like there isn't disagreement that we could initiate that process so that it has some formality, and then that's going to lead to some discussion, I suppose.
Yes.
But other comments?
I agree.
Okay.
Let's do it.
So let's do it.
Would you draft such a letter that we could consider and adopt, sign, and let's get that going? Because I do understand what the neighbors are talking about, and at a fundamentally, we're trying to base our decisions on sound engineering data, not just arbitrary timelines.
And, you know, you obviously, any of them here are free to speak to you, but, you know, one of the things I hear is, how do we market this vacant land? You know, with this condition out there, you know, how does a prospective owner of the property, or even a current owner who's attempting to sell or resell or remarket or lease space, how do they do that with that provision in there that basically says, you mean my access is going to go away in 5 years as I know it? We kind of talked earlier today about inverse condemnation. This kind of seems like that in reverse in some respects.
Is there any obligation to for any public dollars to go into any future roadways to serve private properties up there? Is there any public obligation for contribution to future roadways up there?
That's a good question, and I'll probably leave that to the city attorney's office to give you a formal response. You have a development agreement, and you have a GDP, and you have a plat or a GDP that shows certain things are going to happen by the private landowner.
Mm-hmm.
Those tend to expire by ordinance.
Yep.
But with how enforceable they are, I don't know. So if they showed a road across their property that was to be public, and they haven't built it because and the timeline has expired of the plat or of the GDP, do they still have that obligation? I don't know.
So we have homework for the city attorney's office.
Yes.
All right, other comments from the council? So it sounds like we'll try to initiate that process. We are in agreement on that.
There are some of the property owners here.
Well, I don't want to turn this into a public hearing, but if there are some comments, is that agreeable? Does that sound like an agreeable approach? Let's see if we can get that changed.
That's
the first
start.
Step. Pardon?
That's the first step.
Right. Agreed. Okay. All right.
All right.
Well, we would like to keep 34 had on goal points to 60-50 like they have been. We've got over, you know, close to 30 commercial lots right down there, and we're not going to want to see it a hard way to get in from 65th Street where you can't have a sight line to see where you're going. If you have to drive beyond it to some unknown intersection, you know, it hasn't even been built yet. What would make us happy, I think, would be to keep intersectional with possibly stoplight. Full access down to the 28 to 30 businesses that are down there keeps our property values up there, which in turn you collect your taxes from us. You know, if we start to lose that, the property values go down, maybe the lots don't sell.
Mr.
Kevin Kelly.
I think what I've gone over a few times with Mr. Ketterling is just there's a process here that has to play out, and we want to make sure we're going about it the right way. And so, like you say, this is the first step. The other part is to start probably lobbying your state representatives. And we said a number of times, the city council doesn't have much jurisdiction over MnDOT. In fact, I believe you could probably summate it about zero. So ultimately, a lot of this comes down to lobbying your state representatives to make sure they're supporting the position with MnDOT. We'll send the letter. I think that's a great thing for us to do to show that we're supportive of our local business. We are. But, you know, ultimately, I think a lot of this is going to come down to pressure on MnDOT from your state representative. So we'll do the letter. I think the letter is a great first step. And if you need help lobbying, let me know.
Mr. Freed? In response to Mr. Kelly's comment, the property owners have been, and I think he stated it, are interested in more than condition number 8 going away.
Yeah, right.
So a direction from you, do I want the letter to say more of the point we'd like to sit down and discuss all 8 of these conditions or reconsider the conditions under which the intersection, because really they don't want to close ever.
Right. Well, my personal opinion is let's ask for everything that we think we would like and then negotiate from there or have some discussion from there, but I'll entertain other ideas.
Sorry if Councilmember Wojcik's question was going a slightly different direction. If the church is obligated to build the road and we hit one of the criteria for closing 34th and there is no road in place, I mean, we would be talking about abandoning them or building the road ourselves.
The latter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I would never abandon it. I don't mean it like that. But I just mean the church can't afford to do it. The city is going to have to step in and build the road.
Correct.
Okay.
And, yeah, that's...
I will look at that then as the director.
Yeah. I would say that for me this is about condition number 8 because the others are tied to public safety and part of the reason why the intersection is there. And
so you would favor just limiting the request to
I'm not going to play the games of keeping the intersection open when it's not supposed to be open.
For a lot of requests is a starting point, I think. It's a good place to start.
Once you do with the letter, we could also see if the Lieutenant Governor's office might be of some assistance.
Right. I think what we're trying to figure out is how the context of the letter. I'm hearing some people favoring a broader request. Mr. Wojcik would like to stay more focused. What are the others think?
I mean, you just made a statement about we're going to base this on the data. Data tells us when we close the intersection.
Well, it tells us when we need to improve the intersection, not necessarily close it. Closing is one way to fix the problem, but it's not the only way.
Okay.
Mr. Belovin? We can shoot for the moon, but I do believe that we have to look out for safety ultimately.
Oh, certainly.
Go ahead and try it. Again, I agree with Mr. Wojcik saying that safety's got to be the override.
Is me?
So a bite there is what we're talking about now. I don't know if I'm following this through. A bite at that intersection, keep it open, and have safety at the same time.
Yeah, we're merely suggesting that we'll draft the note to suggest we want to revisit all of the points. Yeah. Not that the solution may not necessarily have to be that they close the intersection, but again, this is just a letter to say we want to revisit, talking about this. Yeah. So.
I'm
sorry.
I was just thinking that we're not in the best bargaining position with MnDOT, are we?
No.
So I'm wondering if you have all of these points, would they just disregard the letter?
Yes, they will.
I suspect they will anyways.
So are you indicating that the letter should cover, you want to look at all 8 points or just the 8 points?
I'm hearing discussion going either way, but I understand the driver for public safety, and so I think all I'm saying is that any changes should be substantiated by good sound information, whether it stays open, it changes, it closes, whatever. The timing is just one element of it, and I think that's arbitrary, but any other changes to that area in terms of roadway should be data-driven or engineering-driven.
But I do believe that Mr. Campion is, in his statement, is let's just at least talk about it, reopen it to have that discussion.
Yeah. Sir, did you have a comment?
You need to know that there's many intersections just like that in the state of Minnesota that aren't closed. I mean, we could come up with maybe 20 or 30 in the state of Minnesota that had that same setup. They have not closed up. That light needs to stay there for all the property owners. Otherwise, the land values will all go down. And it's not like only one place in the state of Minnesota that has that situation. There's lots.
Yeah, I guess, and I agree with it. Yeah, and I was going to say the difference for a lot of those other places, they don't have a signed agreement saying we will close it.
Right.
I guess Council President Staver's point, I would just suggest we could revisit the city will close and relocate 34th Avenue and close existing connection. We could simply say we'll improve, right? Because a lot of these failures, these engineering failures, can actually be addressed with other improvements at the intersection.
Yes.
So, I mean, we could simply open the door to renegotiating what the improvement looks like in that area.
And we'll see what kind of reception we get. I think some of us are expecting we'll just be met with dead silence, but at least we've got to try. Then we can maybe bring some of the legislators to the end of the discussion.
I'm relative to even wager on it.
I think you might hear some of the shred. All right, so where are we at? What context do you want this letter to take? Or do you have an idea?
We'll take a broad context
okay.
as I address it for your consideration.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, good deal. Thank you. All right, is there anything else for this afternoon? Otherwise, I will see everyone this evening.
Dale.
Is that different than silence?
Dale.
I'm just curious because I want to take the bet.